Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, Thursday, June 17, 1999, 8 a.m. here in Muncie. Senator Charles Starr is chair.
Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, and open that public hearing on House Bill 3556 and invite Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, State Representative from House District 13. House Bill 3556 requires licensing for persons installing or repairing elevators. Every day in the state of Oregon, thousands of people go up and down in elevators in many areas, especially since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Their use is greatly extended across the state, and I believe that by having a licensing for this area, it would be a greater comfort level for all the general public in the state of Oregon. And for those reasons, I put the bill in, and I'd like Mr. Gervais to give you more of the details.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Gervais, and I represent the International Union of Elevator Constructors on this bill. Essentially, as I've talked to many of you, the Attorney General in the last interim ruled that there was no statutory authority for the mechanical portion of the training that's been historically behind the elevator license. And that's 70% of the training, and it's about 90% of the safety mechanisms. And in the notebook that I gave you, as it shows, there have been some fatalities, even from dumbwaiters, that were one in Medford last year, where a contractor, the licensing wouldn't help because the contractor didn't take out a permit, didn't use a licensed person, and it was never inspected. But the licensed contractor used a licensed electrician to make the installation. The dumbwaiter didn't work correctly. Kept sticking. The person used a crowbar to break it loose. It came down on her and pinned her, and eventually she had enough time to basically twist the elevator to an L shape before she died. But it was a very unfortunate situation. And again, I represent electrical contractors, electricians. They don't have the training or the backing to do elevators and do the safety portions. The 3556 is designed to reinstate the mechanical training historically, and nothing more than that. I worked with Representative Simmons in terms of the Dash 3 amendments. The reason for that being, we want to make sure that industrial plants around the state where they've used some elevators, that we don't take away the right for the people that do the day-to-day work on the maintenance and the service for them to continue to do that. And that's what the Dash 3 is all about. The Dash 4 amendments are by the department. We're not as enamored with them, but if they're needed to pass the bill, then we can live with it. I would say to you that this is probably the most important safety issue of the construction industry this session, just in terms of making sure the public is protected, especially from the high-rise elevator aspect of it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? No questions. Thank you very much. Joe Brewer.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer, administrator of the Building Codes Division. We have worked with the proponents of the bill to bring forward some necessary amendments that would provide for allowing individuals that work only on the mechanical aspects of elevators to be licensed to do so as well. That license would provide for the scope of work, the activity that they're currently involved in. These individuals, for instance, might be installers of wheelchair lifts, devices of that nature. We've also proposed amendments that we understand the proponents are willing to accept with respect to grandfathering provisions, so that individuals that are currently involved in these activities can also receive a license. With that, the division is supportive of the bill, and we'd encourage the committee's favorable consideration. Be happy to take any questions.
The question I have, if we adopt the dash fours, which you proposed, do we also need the dash threes?
Mr. Chairman, I must admit I'm not prepared to answer that question. I believe so. I defer that to Mr. Gervais. The dash threes were his proposal.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is John Gervais. As I recall reading them, I don't think that the Legislative Council incorporated three into four. So I think you need to move. At least it won't hurt to do both anyway.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, it looks to me like dash three is incorporated into the dash four amendment.
Is it? Okay. We got those at 4:30 last night. And
okay. Then incorporated, then I think that it would be the chair's desire then to move the dash four amendments. Anyone else testifying? Close the public hearing, open the work session.
I move the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3556.
Senator Courtney has moved the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3556. Any discussion? Any objections? The hearing none, so ordered.
I move House Bill 3556 as amended to the dash recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved House Bill 3556 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Byer? Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Chair
Clark? Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 3556. Has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Courtney will carry.
I'll carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You've got to set up late. I've tested many of them for
some
time. Yeah. We've got a thought meeting list of stuff that everybody can understand.
Come on, I'm back to do a work session. Well, I can get
seventh grade level
in here. 28-25.
Okay.
Open the work session on House Bill 2875.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, 2875 is the bill that authorizes the taking of cruisers that pose a threat to public safety. We had a public hearing on this measure on the 4th of June. We do have the dash A4 amendments before us, and those amendments remove the public safety language from the ballot measure 18 language in 498.164 and put it somewhere in chapter 498. So you're not taking away the concept, you're just moving it to another part of the chapter.
That's all the dash 4 amendments.
That's all the dash 4 amendments do. You should have a hand and brush copy of the bill before you.
So we move the dash 4?
Yes.
Okay, I move the dash 4 amendment to the Senate Bill, House Bill 2875A.
Senator Shannon has moved the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2875. Discussion? Objection?
Hi, I'm Senator. My name is Allie Miller. I'm a diversified Oregonian from the Comical era.
This is a work session.
I understand I did not have an opportunity to be notified of the public being able to speak in June, and I would request an opportunity to talk with you. I am not from Portland. I'm a cattle rancher's daughter.
We have your testimony in our file.
Have you reviewed that, Senator?
I have. Yes, okay. Thank you.
Senator Starr, I have some questions about the cougar issue with trophy hunters. Is it true that cougars get $6,000 a head for a trophy?
have no idea.
Senator Starr, there are some rumors going around that I feel that need to be answered for the general public. I've heard some rumors that the cougars and bears are being captured by professional trophy hunters and dropped off.
You are out of order. And we'll have you removed from the room if you don't.
I will leave in a moment, but I want
would
to
you please
answered as a taxpaying citizen.
Could you please?
And I will ask these questions in the newspaper.
Well, please do. Thank you. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Aye. Senator Dyer. Senator Courtney. Senator Turner.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye. Dash four amendments have been moved into the bill. Motion to move. Senator Tarno has moved the bill as amended. The floor to do pass recommendation.
I'd like to just say isn't this basically put into statute what the State Fish and Wildlife Commission has already established in their treaty rules?
In the rules, that's correct.
So it was just put in the statute?
Correct.
And it has to...
Thank you.
Okay, and it has to have been a public threat.
That's correct.
The cougar has to have been, okay.
It's called to say human safety, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For safety.
Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shannon.
Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Senator Dyer. Senator Courtney. Senator Tarno.
Aye.
Senator
aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2875 has moved forward to do pass recommendation. The chair will carry. We will
okay.
Let's see the
idea for the
okay. We have want to open a work session on drafting requests.
Mr. Chair, move the following Senate rules and elections request. It is 617 for drafting a subsequent introduction. Number one is a memorial for former Representative Leo Thornton. You take it one at a time or do both, Mr. Chair?
That's one at a time, sir. Any discussion? All know that Leo Thornton, former representative, just passed away a few weeks ago. And that's why we're doing the memorial. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Senator Byers. Senator Courtney. Senator Turner.
Aye.
Krista.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. We've moved the drafting request for a memorial to former Representative Leo Thornton.
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the following rules, Senate rules and elections request. It is 617 for drafting and subsequent introduction. That's the Senate I resolution.
Like that, I did it 612. Oh, it's too late. 617. Actually. All right. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Byers, Senator
Courtney,
Senator Turner. Aye. MC, the necessary majority, we approve the drafting request for the signed resolution. Thank you. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 99.
Is this a public hearing?
Public hearing.
Oh.
I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 99 was sent over to us from the Water and Land Use Committee. There have been three amendments drafted the Senate Bill 99. Before you are the Dash 3 amendments. We have two individuals, Dave Honeycutt from Oregonians in Action and Ron Eber from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, that would like to speak to the Dash 3 amendments together if the chair pleases. What the Dash 3 amendments do is essentially what they take mass gathering of less than 3,000 people out of the land use statutes and maintain that issue within the law enforcement statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Starr. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 99. Senate Bill 99 is an attempt to solve a problem that I think arises in more than one county, but the specific situation that we're trying to resolve is one that arises in Washington County in your district, Senator Starr. I was asked to prepare some amendments by Representative Starr to deal with that problem, and those are the Dash 3 that you see in front of you. Under current Oregon law, there's a real disconnect, and I think Mr. Eber will speak to that. He's prepared a chart on this chalkboard that we can talk about. A disconnect over when something stops being a land use decision that should be regulated by the zoning ordinance, and when it becomes more of a decision that should be regulated under public health and safety. Under the current mass gatherings ordinance that was passed in 1971, if you have a gathering of more than 3,000 people, that will last for more than 120 hours within any 3-month period. That is, I believe, and I think Mr. Eber concurs, a land use decision. That's a decision that has to be made under the zoning ordinance. If you have a gathering of more than 3,000 people, that lasts between 24 and 120 hours in any 3-month period. The case law, the LUBA opinions say that that isn't a land use decision. That's not controlled by the zoning ordinance. Now, the disconnect comes when you have gatherings that are less than 3,000 people, and that will last, without the time limit. If you have a gathering of less than 3,000 people, it's not clear whether or not that is a land use decision. So we have, you could conceivably have counties saying that you have to apply for a land use permit to have a family wedding or a picnic or something of that nature. I don't think that's what's happening now, but conceivably that's what you could have under the law. And so what we're trying to do is say if a gathering of more than 3,000 people that lasts from 24 to 120 hours isn't a land use decision, then a gathering of less than 3,000 people that lasts less than 120 hours shouldn't be a land use decision either. The gatherings will still be regulated by the local government and by the state, conceivably, under the health and safety regulations. They just simply won't be governed by the zoning ordinance. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Eber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. To follow up on what Mr. Honeycutt is pointing out, this is not a hypothetical matter. I get questions continually. Some examples, the Sheridan Chamber of Commerce wanted to have a home and garden show out on someone's property. This particularly arises in farm zones. There may be a country fair that needs camping spots for a couple of days. There was a question in Washington County last year with a concert that was held in conjunction with the Peter Jacobson Golf Tournament, rodeo events, picnics, and fundraisers. And whether or not those are land use matters or whether or not they are just simply covered under the mass gathering statute has always been somewhat unclear. There is a LUBA and Court of Appeals case, Spence versus Jackson County, that made it clear that the mass gatherings are not subject to the zoning regulations. And I, if you want to get into this further, I have a little chart that kind of points this out, but I think I can say from looking at this amendment, tentatively, I think it's okay. It doesn't authorize anything in as a land use matter that should normally come within the land use statutes. It is clear that counties have the authority under the mass gathering statute to change the definition of a mass gathering. So if they want to regulate something that is either more than 120 hours or less than 3,000 people, they can do so. The statute is written where they must issue the permit, but it's only subject to health and safety standards. So this would make it clear that those activities, these short duration, temporary kind of activities, are not subject to the zoning regulations, just simply health and safety regulations. I think if this bill moves, the language may need some further clarification, and it may be important to also point out and make the full connection that the items that are the large-scale gatherings, the ones over 3,000 people and over 120 hours, actually are subject in the land use statutes as a land use decision. With that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We don't have any opposition.
I don't believe so. I know. I see Mr. Schlack is here, so.
We're,
Oh, we've gotten along so well this session.
We're running tight on time because I'm going to lose a member here in about 2 minutes.
We got these at 4 o'clock yesterday.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Justice.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I would just like to put on the record at this point, we have not had an opportunity to review this, nor have I had an opportunity to send it out to the counties to see what kind of response they would have and to determine how many counties, if any, are, from a land use standpoint, requiring permits for gatherings less than 3,000. As you've heard, counties have the ability at this point to, through their ordinances, go below 3,000 people at this point. So I want to express a concern. Again, we haven't had opportunity. I intend to send this out immediately. And if, based on the comments that I received, we may be in opposition to this proposal.
Appreciate that very much. We, of course, this bill is, has a torturous route to go yet, being a Senate bill, and we don't know whether it can make it through the process. We will move it out this morning, and if you need to address it, there'll be ample opportunity in the process. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing and the work session.
I move the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 99.
Senator Shannon's moved the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 99. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
I move Senate Bill 99 as amended to the floor of the due pass.
Senator Shannon's moved Senate Bill 99 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Byers? Senator Courtney? Senator
Turner? Aye. Aye. I received the necessary majority. Senate Bill 99, as amended, moved to floor to do pass recommendation. Senator Tarno.
Mr. Chair, I don't feel comfortable in carrying it, because I'm not sure how we need it.
Okay. I will carry.
As I would.
Chair will carry. We're going to open a open a public hearing on House Bill 2238, and Representative Walker. Who else are you bringing up with you?
Nancy Cabe would probably like to testify, I believe. And Representative Mannix is missing in action this time. I'm not quite sure where he is at the moment. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Vicki Walker, State Representative from District 41, Eugene and Springfield. We're here today on House Bill 2238 that passed the House on a vote of 3820 on June 7th. There was a minority report offered on this bill, but the minority report was essentially the same as the committee report, so there was not a problem with the contents of the bill with the rest of my members. It was simply Section 4 and 5 in the bill, the objective 2, which concerns Ms. Cabe and likewise pharmacists. It would allow pharmacists like Ms. Cabe's organization to business to be independent contractors. And I'm here in support of that provision in the bill because I think it's extremely important that Ms. Cabe be given the recognition that the federal government gave her in her case. I'm a court reporter by trade, and in 1996, Ms. Cabe had a case against the Internal Revenue Service, and they claimed that she was not an independent contractor. She met the test. She won her case at the federal level and has since tried to get the state of Oregon to recognize that, and she can explain that more to you. The other elements of the bill that are really important are the extension of unemployment benefits to women who are victims of domestic violence. That's a very critical element of the bill, and there are some other parts of the bill that allow unemployment benefits, the employment department to consider other information when considering unemployment benefits. And as I mentioned, no one seemed to have a problem with those provisions of the bill.
I do.
Except you do.
I do. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I'll tell you why, because I was lobbied on this by a senator that thought that since the woman was shot and killed, you know, and working in Salem, did you read about that?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, and I read the whole situation. And did you read it in Sunday for a Statesman Journal?
Yes, I did.
The man was a convicted felon,
mm-hmm.
and he was convicted of cruelty to children. He was convicted of using a weapon in spousal abuse in California, and the police took him and put him to jail, knowing he was in the middle of a domestic situation, released him on his own recognizance, went to his house, took away handgun, but didn't take a rifle, or he borrowed a rifle that this law would not, and the man was put in jail, and a co-worker bailed him out $500,000, and then he had to, I believe, to help that save that woman's life. We should make the police enforce the laws they have now and not release these men that are in, because the woman went to the police and the wife, you know, and to use that, we need this because of what happened when they had so many laws already that they would have acted on those and or enforce it so they can't be released until they've seen a judge, because felons that are in possession of a gun is a crime. And I already, we've talked to the unemployment people, they are giving women unemployment for this. They just go before the board, explain their situation, their domestic violence. I don't understand why we're asking, and I know they're saying, oh, it doesn't really come out of the employers, but the employers do contribute to this unemployment fund. Why are we going after the woman and making her, so she has an allowance for the job and move and just live on unemployment, when she could continue her full-time job if they put the criminal in jail so he couldn't kill her or the kids? How can you, why don't you want to go and say the police must enforce putting felons in jail?
Senator, this is Representative Yannick's bill, so I can't probably answer you as fully as you could.
No man is asked about the women or after.
Senator, the Mr. Chair and Senator Shannon, this clarifies the existence of good cause. It can be done now, but it's not clear in the law, and so this simply clarifies the ability of a woman who is a victim of domestic violence to qualify for unemployment benefits. And I agree with you. The law should be enforced that we have to prevent this from happening, but it does happen to a large number of women, and I would like to have this opportunity for women to protect themselves.
But what I'm saying, there is a problem, but this isn't a solution. he gets involved in three women, and they're all up on unemployment, and he's still out there to harass, and he's a convicted felon with a gun. I think we need to go after these men.
Representative Jerry Starr, Representative Shannon, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you that we need to go after these men, but we also need to protect the women. And I think that's why this we have here.
I believe they are. You have to act on the rights you already have or you don't have them. And these women have gone before the unemployment board and have asked for this and been granted it. They are being granted it. Many. And I think it's like a false sense of security. Now we have helped because we're going to allow more women on unemployment when we haven't. That terrorist is still out there harassing and killing.
Thank you, Senator Shannon.
I guess I almost feel like my issue is small compared to the life of women that are in the press.
Not at all. Thank you.
Should make the police enforce the laws they have now and not release these men that are in, because the woman went to the police and the wife, you know, and to use that we need this because of what happened when they had so many laws already that they would have acted on those and enforce it so they can't be released until they've seen a judge, because felons, they're in possession of a gun, is a crime. And we've talked to the unemployment people. They are giving women unemployment for this. They just go before the board, explain their situation, they're in domestic violence. I don't understand why we're asking, and I know they're saying, oh, it doesn't really come out of the employers, but the employers do contribute to this unemployment fund. Why are we going after the woman and making her so she has an allowance to quit a job and move and just live on unemployment when she could continue her full-time job if they put the criminal in jail so he couldn't kill her or the kids? Why don't you want to go and say the police must enforce putting felons in jail?
Senator, this is Representative Yannick's bill, so I can't probably answer you as fully as he could.
No man is asked about the women are after.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shannon, this clarifies the existence of good cause. It can be done now, but it's not clear in the law. And so this simply clarifies the ability of a woman who is a victim of domestic violence to qualify for unemployment benefits. And I agree with you. The law should be enforced that we have to prevent this from happening. But it does happen to a large number of women. And I would like to have this opportunity for women to protect themselves.
But what I'm saying, there is a problem, but this isn't a solution. He gets involved in three women, and they're all out on unemployment, and he's still out there to harass, and he's a convicted felon with a gun. I think we need to go after these men.
Representative Jerry Starr, Representative Shannon, I agree with you. Absolutely agree with you that we need to go after these men, but we also need to protect the women. And I think that's why this we have here.
I believe they are. You have to act on the rights you already have or you don't have them. And these women that have gone before the unemployment board and have asked for this have been granted it. They are being granted it. Many. And I think it's like a false sense of security. Now we have help because we're going to allow more women on unemployment when we haven't. That terrorist is still out there harassing and killing.
Thank you, Senator Shannon.
I guess I almost feel like my issue is small compared to the life of the United States.
Not at all. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Chairman Starr and committee, my name is Nancy Eschmeyer Cabe, and I appreciate this opportunity to address the committee in support of House Bill 2238, Section 5. I'm a registered pharmacist in Oregon, and I operate a small business of 12 years out of my home. My business is a brokerage for independent pharmacists, and I contract to their services on a temporary basis. I've met some of you in the past through my volunteer work with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I presently serve on the American Pharmaceutical Association as the vice chair for their PAC committee. I'm here today because of the narrow interpretation of pharmacists being allowed to work as independent contractors through the employment division. My business, I supply temporary pharmacists as independent contractors. And I built the business around the law. I never intended to break the law. I worked with lawyers and accountants to do so. And I feel that I'm being attacked inappropriately. I work as an independent pharmacist, and along with many professionals that contract through my brokerage, take great pride in being independent and are grateful for the choice to be free. The ability to work hard as a free independent business is the cornerstone of the entrepreneurial spirit and supports the successful foundation of our economy. You'll find that the employment division is lobbying heavily against this bill. You have to understand that their present state of mind is that all independent contractors are an abuse of the system. They have no understanding that they're inhibiting the individual's ability to be free of the control of an employer, and this is important to pharmacists in this day and age. Pharmacy has become a highly pressured field in which employer abuse is prevalent. The most recent Oregon State Pharmacists Association article talks about pharmacists having trouble being able to go to the bathroom. I think what I'm going to do is just, the reason I'm here is because I'm afraid that I can win my appeal that I presently am under and still have the employment division go after me because of the viciousness that they have approached me so far. The reason this has occurred is because when my pharmacist filed for unemployment, when she had refused work for me, she had a baby and she didn't want to work anymore. When she filed for unemployment against Kaiser, the employment division didn't ask her why she separated from me and wrote down that she separated from me because she didn't like my bookkeeping practices. She never said that. She testified under oath that she never said that. She testified under oath in front of the judge that she had refused work from me and she was not given benefits. But the employment division has continued to go after me, and they falsified information 8 more times in my case, which is also under oath in the record. So you can see why I'm so afraid, and I'm here today to try and protect my business. I'm going to read for you a letter from one of my pharmacists. My pharmacists are not being taken advantage of. They enjoy the privilege of being able to be free business people. And this is from Mark Sargent of Hillsboro, Oregon. I would like to urge support of House Bill 2238, which provides for independent contractors. And I'm an independent pharmacist who runs his own business. And I've been an independent contractor for over 7 years and hate to think that my individual choices are being taken away from me and my family. I'm in charge of where I work, the times I work, my personal education, licensure, and insurance without the direction of anyone. I belong to professional organizations to increase my knowledge in my field and do not belong to any unions. There is inherent pride in working for oneself, and I've chosen this path because I do not want to work for anyone but me. I'm going to skip down. The fact has been disputed. The government is now trying to take this freedom away from me. Someone is trying to decide because of my profession that I must work for someone else. This greatly angers me, and no one has the right to take my rights away. And you have a packet of about 10 pharmacists that wrote you the same letters. These people want the chance to work freely, and they're not allowed to do it outside of me anymore because the employment division has attacked us so viciously. I really appreciate your time, and it looks like Representative Mannix is here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Mannix.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix of Salem, and Representative Walker's here. I don't know if she's already had a chance to introduce herself. I guess she has. I just arrived, and appreciate your courtesy in allowing me to testify on this bill. I understand there's some sensitivity to the issue in regards to the unemployment compensation benefits which may be allowed for persons who are victims of domestic violence who feel a need to, in effect, back away from a particular job because of concerns for their personal safety. I think that the concerns about where we might be moving with that have to be counterbalanced with our concerns for the safety of citizens who have already been victimized once too often. Once is too often. But twice, being victimized not only by the perpetrator, but then being victimized by society is just too much. This is something that is new. It is experimental in the sense that we've not tested these waters before. It's potentially subject to abuse, but at the same time, I would rather allow the system to go into effect and see whether or not a victim abuses the system rather than see another victim abused again by the system. So I would encourage this committee to send this bill out with the provision in regard to protection for victims of domestic violence. Let's see how this works out there. If we find there are abuses, we can revisit it. But remember, we can always revisit a system and recover money or protect from further expenditure of money. We can't go out there and recover lives. We can't undo physical and psychological injuries. So I would encourage you to send this bill as is with that provision in it. In addition, I understand that there may be some concerns about the interpretation of the clause as to the employment department being able to consider evidence other than presented by the employee or the employer. Actually, this is simply a clause that allows them to look at the real world. It's the kind of evidentiary standard that's used in many administrative hearings and, in fact, legal cases where the court can take administrative notice or, in a court's case, judicial notice of given facts. Certainly, the employment department ought to be able to take notice of information that's in front of it. There's another clause in this bill that the employment department doesn't like, and that's the clause that empowers licensed pharmacists to be able to have their own lives and their own business. The employment department will tell you, if they haven't already, that this is an erosion of coverage. And I say, wait a minute. There never should have been coverage here in the first place. Unemployment compensation insurance, we call it that, was set up to protect the generic workforce from the unanticipated layoffs that might occur with the vagaries of the economy. It was never set up to protect businesses from the vagaries of the economy. It was never set up to protect licensed professionals from the vagaries of their professional work. Unfortunately, the Employment Department has taken an extremely aggressive approach and a patronizing socialistic approach towards the employment coverage. And in fact, they want to shove everybody into the status, and I call it that, the status of being somebody else's employee. Yet we have had people who time and again have come to the legislature saying, free us from these shackles. And what are they? They are monetary shackles because the employer and the employee, in effect, are having to pay into an unemployment compensation fund, a tax, to protect them from a potential layoff. Excuse me for hitting the mic. When actually what we're talking about is a system where sometimes people actually do like to take risks, do like to go out there and develop their own professional or business service. We have a whole list of exclusions from coverage because individuals or groups came in and said, would you please let us just do our own thing? We understand the risk of not having the next business lined up, the next opportunity to do business lined up. What pharmacist has come in front of the legislature in the last 6 years to say, please protect me from myself, please protect me from my job opportunity? The answer is zip, none, nada in Spanish, nothing.
And yet the Employment Department is here to tell you that they must protect these poor souls from themselves. These poor souls who simply want to go out there and have an opportunity and offer their services to a variety of clients through a brokerage. There's 30 to 50 of these folks in the state, apparently, and yet the Employment Department has made a federal case out of it. Well, in response, some of us have said, well, we're going to make a federal case out of the concept that this just goes too far. Allow the exemption or exclusion, if you wish, just as we've done for court reporters. Now, in the House, we had some major changes in philosophy and coverage issues, which we stripped out of this bill in deference to the Employment Department. We took that all out. That wasn't enough for them. This little extra piece, allowing licensed pharmacists a little bit of peace of mind, apparently rankles the Employment Department. I encourage this committee to overlook the rankled minds of the Employment Department and look at the realities of the situation and grant these pharmacists their freedoms. Freedom to do business without having to be tied to the employment system. If you look at the exclusions from coverage, you'd find it's almost humorous that we allow, get this, golf caddies to be excluded from coverage. We let newspaper carriers to be excluded from coverage. You can imagine these little 12-year-olds out there somehow can be excluded from coverage. But we won't let a licensed professional pharmacist who's out there trying to provide professional services, who has his own insurance program, to be excluded from coverage. It boggles the mind. I think I've said enough about that topic. And I would say, too, that perhaps 4 years from now or 2 years from now, we can revisit the question about the domestic violence coverage and see whether or not there's been any abuse. I believe strongly there will not be any abuse, and that is a very important positive thing to do. Thank you.
Question, Senator Beyer.
Representative Mann, should we just expand this and make it all professional services, exclude all professional services from unemployment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I have seriously proposed that, but we backed away from that because that was seen as too radical and too much of a policy change. I do think you might consider adding a provision to this bill that says that during the interim there should be a review of professional services and the capability of professionals such as court reporters, who also have an exclusion, to be able to have an exclusion clause that generally relates to licensed professionals who have their own insurance, their own liability insurance plan. And I would welcome I'll call it a study, but at the same time, the pharmacists have fought for at least 3 sessions, I think, for this protection, and I would encourage that be allowed to them as a narrow protection. At the same time, that you may want to say, let's have a directive for an interim review of that idea.
So would you argue then that in Section 5, maybe we ought to at least amend this to say that it doesn't include the services of any licensed pharmacist?
I'd have to take a look at the particular language you're referring to.
This has limited language. It says only those who are in temporary pharmacy duties. I don't know whether currently pharmacists that I think that the days of the independent pharmacy are almost gone, and all pharmacists now work for somebody.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, there are a few independent pharmacies still out there, and there are pharmacists who want to be independent and going in from place to place to step in and provide services as pharmacists. But there are also pharmacists who quite legitimately ought to be considered employees. The pharmacist who works 40 hours a week for Fred Meyer or for Rite Aid or whatever really is an employee. They're told what hours they have to work. They're told where they have to work. We're talking about pharmacists who decide when and where they're going to work by saying they'll do fill-in services or they'll come in and cover for a small-town pharmacy that's closed for vacation or would have been closed for vacation, but the pharmacist arranges to contract with somebody.
Let me ask you a different way then. Should we be saying that anybody who works for a temporary service should be excluded from unemployment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, no, because many people who work through temporary services do not have specialized licenses and skills that they are offering. I would say that if we got into accountants and attorneys and other professionals there are attorneys out there who move from law firm to law firm doing specialized projects. They have not yet been subjected to the assault of being told that they're employees, although I would say that theoretically they too could be covered by the philosophy taken by the Employment Department. But right now, we have not. There's some of them go to work somewhere regularly as employees.
They're not clear. the common ads, the account temps. I think you have a lot of accountants who work temporarily through that, retired accountants. So I imagine, are they excluded from coverage now if they're working through a temp service?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I would say generally not. There may be accountants out there right now who are, who, or at least who think they are, who are carrying on that kind of practice. But I dare say if you ask the employment department, they would say that they are not excluded. Unless, and then they'd run them through the independently established business requirement, which would essentially run them through a whole list of tests. And if you're moving from place to place providing your services, and if your mind is your tool, the employment department seems to think that's not enough. There was discussion, by the way, back in 1989 on the record with Senator Houck, then Senator Houck, saying that what about folks who use their, you know, their training and their mental skills but don't have physical tools to trade? And at the time, it was all said, no, your education and your license are your tools of the trade. And apparently that's no longer the perspective of the employment department. I do think that the issue will arise more in the future as we have people who move from place to place providing the services that consider themselves to be independently in business as professionals and may well be told if there's ever a review that no, they are not, and they are subject to the employment law. That's where I think an interim study of this topic would be very helpful. But we do have an identified group here who documented that they want an exclusion, as did the court reporters, and I would encourage you to grant them that exclusion while we cogitate over whether or not there ought to be a broader professional exclusion and bring those folks in to have a conversation. I would hate to do an exclusion and find out that they didn't think that they should be given an exclusion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, if I might, there is a very extensive test that you have to meet through the Internal Revenue Service. It's over 20 points, and I had my husband bring up my file last night. I didn't go home, and that is, the test is not in my file. I don't know what I've done with it, but it's very extensive. And in this case, yeah, and this case won her case at the federal level. I mean, she met that test. So it was pretty clear. And I myself am an independent contractor and declared that conflict on the record when we voted on this bill. And I actually work for the federal government as an independent contractor. I found it very unusual as working on this case. I did want to comment just one further note on Senator Shannon's concern about the unemployment compensation for domestic violence victims. She did indicate that women can ask for that now, and that is true, but it's a very subjective decision on the part of the hearings officer. What we want to do is put it in statute, have it defined, so that the hearings officer opens the book, sees the definition of domestic violence, and it does not have to be this proof shown that she needs all these tests. I think it's very important. There was no opposition to that. There was an earlier bill that we voted on in the House, and it passed unanimously, and it dealt only with that issue. And we have now rolled that into this bill. It affects less than 1% on the unemployment insurance fund. It's just not a great impact at all. It would apply to about 40 to 50 women per year, as estimated by the employment department. It's just a really important piece to this bill, and I would really urge you to consider passage.
Thank you very much. We are limited in our time. Chair has to leave at 9:15. We have two further witnesses, we have three. Why don't you come up together, even though you may be speaking on opposite sides of the issue, we'll have Tom Holt, Annette Talbot, and Tricia Smith.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association, cognizant of the time. I'll be very brief. I just would like to note, in light of Senator Beyer's question, that for the record, we have more than 230 independent pharmacies among our membership, and I expect to have half a dozen new pharmacies open this summer that will be independently owned, so the days are far from numbered. Our interest in this bill is the section dealing with the pharmacists, of course, and you know, I just would like to point out that While most people can let their work pile up when they go on vacation, pharmacists have to find replacements because people still need their medications. And the independent contractors who work as replacement pharmacists play a very critical role in allowing patients to have continued access to care, particularly in rural areas. They also provide an element of competition that is very needed in what is a fairly limited marketplace. So the earlier testimony is there's 30 to 50 people involved in this type of business in the state. So it's very important that they be allowed to continue to function. Ms. Cave has litigated and won at the federal level, and it seems to us that ought to be good enough, and the state ought to take yes for an answer. With that, I would urge that the committee approve the bill as is, although we do like Representative Maddox's idea of having a further inquiry into this issue of independent contractors, as we expect in our practice, at least, there will be more rather than fewer people engaged in independent business.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Ned Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. I do realize that you have a time limitation. However, I think that it's pretty important for the record to clarify the Employment Department's position on this bill. And it is not the Employment Department that has created the test about who is an independent contractor. It is the legislature in 1989 in bipartisan legislative support with labor and management agreements that created a statutory test to determine who is and who is not an independent contractor. That test is attached to our testimony. There are various things that have been placed into House Bill 2238. It was an Employment Department bill initially, and we are in the unfortunate position of opposing our own bill at this point in time. The bill as introduced was a bill that would help the department clarify a court of appeals case so that it would be clearly able to interpret our insurance laws to decide whether a person quit or was discharged for misconduct, which has an impact also on an employer's experience rating, and we would like to clarify that court case. Nonetheless, the Section 5 regarding the pharmacist for us is the poison pill in the bill. At this point in time, we are in litigation with Ms. Cave, so I can't speak to her case particularly. It is pending at the Court of Appeals. What I can say is that the governor has asked the department to take a strong stand in regards to erosion of coverage for workers. There are certain exclusions currently under state law for workers. In every session, another group of employers come in to exclude their set of workers. What we believe should be studied, if the legislature wishes to direct us to, we will, is does the current test that's been in place for a decade work? If it does not, then we should amend the test. We should not set forth a narrow exclusion for one group of pharmacists who work at one temporary agency. The test seemingly works. It's fairly easy to meet if you truly are an independent contractor, and therefore, we believe that that should be what the legislature looks to. The test isn't working. We should look at amending the test for all individuals, and we would be more than happy to study that. At this point in time, as I said, however, we are unable to support the bill because it contains Section 5, and the governor would also be able to not support the bill because of that. So we would respectfully ask the committee to strike out Sections 4 and 5 if they would, so that the other pieces of the bill could go forward. The Employment Department is neutral on the domestic relations piece. I think there was some misinformation before about that. So if you have any questions on clarifying the domestic violence piece, we do provide some benefits through an administrative rule for people who voluntarily quit with good cause. Good cause can be considered domestic violence if a person has pursued reasonable alternatives before quitting, such as asking for a relocation to another employer's location if they have multiple sites, or getting a restraining order from the person who's abusing them. So this would put it in statute, however, clearly identify what reasonable alternatives need to be pursued. The other portion of the bill relates to layoffs and a collective bargaining situation. We're also neutral on that, but it would clarify the law in regards to collective bargaining situations where there is no seniority and the boss comes to the site and says, we need five people to go by Friday. Who would like to be the first to leave? In that situation, we want to make it clear that the person isn't quitting. They are just volunteering to leave at that time. So those are the four pieces of the bill. And as I said, the department is opposed to the special exclusion for temporary pharmacists, but we would be more than willing to look at the test over the interim to see if it needs to be revised now that it's been in place over a decade. Also, just for the record, there is no exclusion for court reporters currently, so I'm not sure what that reference was for. If court reporters meet the independent contractor test, then they would be excluded, but they do have to meet the test. We believe that the specialized skills of an employee is really not the issue. Is if they're an employee, they deserve to receive benefits if they're unemployed through no fault of their own. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public employee union of 17,000 classified employees in Oregon's schools, ESDs, community colleges, park and rec districts, and Head Start programs. I'm here to strongly support the first three sections of Senate Bill 2238 and to appeal to the committee to strike out the last two sections, sections 4 and 5, so that the first three sections can move forward. Senate Bill 2238 began, as Ms. Talbot said, as a department bill, kind of a housekeeping bill. It really didn't strike up a lot of interest or controversy anywhere until sections 3, 4, and 5 were added to the bill and a couple of other sections which were ultimately not added to the bill that don't have much to do with the intent and the reason the bill was introduced in the first place. Section 3 is a section of the bill that was added because House Bill 2813, which passed unanimously in the House and contained as its total the domestic violence piece of this bill, passed unanimously in the House and came to the Senate where we understand it will not be heard. So the chair of the House Consumer Business Affairs Committee requested that this language be put into House Bill 2238. This language has the sponsors of this language worked with NFIB and AOI to assure that the language was comfortable to them. They offered suggestions which were incorporated into the bill which require particular and specific steps of an abuse victim to be taken before they are eligible for unemployment under this act. And I would appeal to you that this is critically, critically important. This is a part of escape from abuse that we haven't closed, our needs in and allowed a victim to be safe. Victims have shelter available to them, victims, if they're lucky. They have support services, but when they're trying to flee an abuser, first of all, statistics show that they're,
Also, just for the record, there is no exclusion for court reporters currently, so I'm not sure what that reference was for. If court reporters meet the independent contractor test, then they would be excluded, but they do have to meet the test. We believe that the specialized skills of an employee is really not the issue. If they're an employee, they deserve to receive benefits if they're unemployed through no fault of their own. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, the public employee union of 17,000 classified employees in Oregon's schools, ESDs, community colleges, park and rec districts, and Head Start programs. I'm here to strongly support the first three sections of Senate Bill 2238 and to appeal to the committee to strike out the last two sections, sections 4 and 5, so that the first three sections can move forward. Senate Bill 2238 began, as Ms. Talbot said, as a department bill, kind of a housekeeping bill. It really didn't strike up a lot of interest or controversy anywhere until sections 3, 4, and 5 were added to the bill, and a couple of other sections which were ultimately not added to the bill that don't have much to do with the intent and the reason the bill was introduced in the first place. Section 3 is a section of the bill that was added because House Bill 2813, which passed unanimously in the House and contained as its total the domestic violence piece of this bill, passed unanimously in the House and came to the Senate where we understand it will not be heard. So the chair of the House Consumer Business Affairs Committee requested that this language be put into House Bill 2238. This language has the sponsors of this language worked with NFIB and AOI to assure that the language was comfortable to them. They offered suggestions which were incorporated into the bill which require particular and specific steps of an abuse victim to be taken before they are eligible for unemployment under this act. And I would appeal to you that this is critically, critically important. This is a part of escape from abuse that we haven't closed our needs in and allowed a victim to be safe. Victims have shelter available to them. Victims, if they're lucky, they have support services. But when they're trying to flee an abuser, first of all, statistics show that their risk of being murdered increases 75% when they leave. And the one place the abuser knows where to find them is at work. The importance of this particular amendment is not so just for abuse victims. It's also important for employers. Employers are liable for a safe and helpful workplace. And if an abuse victim is fleeing her abuser and is in danger of her life, and her abuser knows she is at work, as happened in Salem last week, he can find her there. Last week, a young woman, mother of two children, was murdered in a parking lot in downtown Salem by her husband. He knew she was coming to work, so he knew he could find her there. This bill would have given her perhaps another alternative. And so it's very important that the legislature recognize that this is the place victims are not protected no matter what they do. She had a restraining order. She did all the things that the law tells an abuse victim to do in order to protect herself, and still she was murdered because she had to go to work. So it's so important that Section 3 be passed. I will also tell you that I appeal to you to take out Sections 4 and 5, because if you don't, the bill won't become the law, and those victims won't have the protection of Section 3. If you think that independent contractor status needs to be studied, I encourage you to direct the department to do that. There are many who also believe that the exemptions that currently exist in the employment law should be reviewed and perhaps repealed. So maybe the time is right for that kind of a study. But I appeal to you not to put women further at risk with a certain veto on a bill when there are other alternatives to sections 4 and 5.
Thank you very much. Questions? I'm going to close the public hearing and open a session. Chair? Chair's desire to move the bill as is or not at all?
Thank you for making my life less stressful, Mr. Chair.
Two very important aspects of this bill. 1, 2, 3, I think is absolutely something that we need. I think that sections 4 and 5 probably would be a good issue to have debate on the floor. I think it's worthy of that. Probably as many could ought to go before the floor debate.
You don't get that debate, though.
Why not, Chair?
Well, because it's one of those bills that's two parts of it. One's very good, maybe one's not good. So you don't really get that kind of debate. You don't individually get to debate it the way you'd like to. There's just 4 and 5 on the floor, up or down, if you know what I mean. You don't get that kind of clean debate. That's life. But that's how it is.
I think you do too, man.
The chair feels that the issue in section 4 and 5 has been not just brought to us this time. Now it's second time around. It's an issue that's pretty narrow. Personally, I believe that further study is necessary, but there are others who may or may not need to be exempted. But I, having worked as an independent contractor for over 20 years, I realize how we tend to be affected by government servants who are bound by the law as they see it. And I think this narrow exemption, as has been reported to us by the Pharmacy Association, by an individual who is being abused by that law as it stands on the books, needs the protection that this bill provides for them. And I very strongly want to go forward. But I guess I'm perfectly willing to let it die right here if we can.
Mr. Chair, can we get
Shannon's out of the building, unfortunately. We could carry it over.
Yeah, we're not going to, just so you know, how do I say it? You want to say it, Lee?
You're going to go through the book?
I'm not going to.
I have a question. Yes. I have a question of the CAM. Is that my favorite? Yeah.
Please.
I'm not going to let the bill dodge.
Okay. Yeah. Help me understand your service. Are you the only one in the state providing the building service?
There's one other business out of California that does the same thing that I do.
And when you broker this, the payment goes from Faith and Albertsons. The payment goes from Albertsons to the pharmacy that you placed there?
Well, the reason it's not structured that way, and I would have rather had it structured that way, but because the accounts don't want to pay, like I might send a different pharmacist every day for a week, and they don't want to send a check to each one of the pharmacists, so I wait until I gather the money and then I send it out. I don't pay the pharmacist before I'm paid, and that's not a problem under the law. That doesn't seem to be a problem with the employment. That's not a problem under present law. But I do gather the money and pay them. I kind of consider it that I'm happy as a bookkeeper for them.
Do you have to just
Do you have to withhold and pay taxes for them?
I don't. I filed 1099s on them, and I've always filed 1099s, so the income is reported.
Direct tax.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I'm acting like a bookkeeper.
As a normal practice, do they usually work 5 days in a calendar year for a business?
Well, I have accounts with all of the chains, and I have about 50% of my business is independent, and so they work all over the place. I kind of contract day by day. I contract shift by shift. They say they want to work this day. I tell them what's available, and they can say yes or no. So it's a shift by shift agreement between us.
But how many times in a year would the normal independent pharmacist work for a specific pharmacy?
It varies quite a bit. Rarely is someone in the same store for a week. You know, it's not like they're working for the same place consistently. They don't do that at all. I mean, you're trying to say, should they be an employee there because they're there for a month, for instance? No, they're not. They're not. Rarely is someone there for a week. Very rarely. And it's mainly because the pharmacists don't want to be there for a week. They want, you know, they have their own schedule, and that's what these people like so much. They can work when they want to. They don't have to work when they don't want to. And if they're employed, they're very rigidly controlled about how they work and where they work and when they work.
You have somebody that may be working every weekend at some place?
No, the same place, no. Because they don't want to work every weekend. If they wanted to work every weekend, they could work as an employee every weekend. You see, the employment opportunities are tremendous. And the ability to be free is not there in pharmacy right now. There are stores that are closed, Rite Aid stores that are closed, but there's no employee pharmacists that will come and make $45 an hour in that store. But these people don't want to do that. They want to be free to work by themselves.
When they work in a store, does state pharmacy rules allow them to work independent? I mean, will they be by themselves, or are they working in under the direction of another pharmacist?
No, they're not. A pharmacist never works as an employee or an independent. As far as the law, state law, they're always independent in that sense, but they're not independent in the sense of what they wear and what they say to customers and when they have to work. You see, practice of pharmacy is always free, although a pharmacist got fired for Fred Meyer for not dispensing Moniatropil. An independent contractor couldn't get fired.
We are running out of time, folks. We got another bill that I'd like to take care of.
I'm sorry, this took so long. Conspiracy.
Not your problem.
We don't have a problem, Mr. Dean, do you?
Here's the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move the new House Bill 2238 with 40 factual conditions.
Senator Tarnow has moved House Bill 2238 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shannon, Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Tarnow.
Aye.
Chair Starr.
Aye. I receive necessary majority. House Bill 2238 moved to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Byer.
I'm not sure how we're doing this, but just as a recommendation, I should take it back to your leadership meetings. This really is an issue that could deserve some study over the interim. It comes up frequently, and I think this needs some work.
Appreciate that very much. I agree with you. Chair will carry this bill. That will close the work session. Open up. Public hearing on House Bill 3383, and appreciate all the folks waiting here patiently. We are
what do you mean?
Just Ways and Means. All right. Not go to Ways and Means. We briefly, folks, we've got just a couple of minutes. No amendments?
No amendments, no nothing.
Okay.
Gary Anson, House District 17, no amendments, good bill should pass.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Brewer.
58-0 in the House.
Any opposition, Joe?
Move the bill.
Joe's got extensive testimony. Let's
Expensive, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
My name's Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. The only thing the agency wanted to point out on the record is that this is additional responsibility, additional administrative rules, and inspections will be required if the board exercises this authority. So the division respectfully requests 2.5 full-time positions, and the overall cost will be approximately $250,000 per biennium. And all that's in the fiscal impact statement that has been provided, I'm sure.
We don't have that. I don't have one.
Business license. So there are revenues to cover?
Yes.
And it went away, means from the house.
Oh, it has to be away from me?
Has been.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Let's close public hearing and open work session.
Chair, I would move House Bill 3383 to the floor. Would you do that?
Senator Byers moved House Bill 3383 to the floor to pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator Cortez?
Yes.
Senator
Turner? Aye.
Chair Sparrow?
Aye. I receive necessary majority. House Bill 3383 moved the floor to do pass. Senator Barr, would you carry?
Sure. Thank you. Need to give you the money?
Thank you very much. Appreciate your patience. We're good.